Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 18th of November. As farmers prepare to descend on London tomorrow to voice their opposition to the Chancellor's inheritance tax changes, we hear from one of them, from a Labour MP, and we assess how much trouble the row is causing for the government. Also, will Ukraine's European allies follow Joe Biden's lead and allow their long-range missiles to be fired into Russia? What's behind the rise and fall of olive oil prices? How Eric and Ernie nearly didn't bring us sunshine? And the King's speech recreated. We speak to the man who imagined how Richard III spoke for his new digital avatar. What began as a post-budget rumble of discontent has been developing into something louder and more substantial. That was the sound of tractor horns at the Welsh Labour conference at the weekend as farmers protested about changes to the inheritance tax rules, which will mean some farms losing their exemption. Exactly how many will be affected remains the subject of spreadsheets and much debate. What is clear, though, is that the issue has struck a nerve, and tomorrow a much larger rural protest is planned in central London. I asked the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason, how much of a headache this is proving to be for the government.
The bottom line is here, we're a good couple of weeks on now from the budget, and this row is not going away. In fact, the opposite, it is getting louder, noisier and more angry. So the other day when Labour had their Welsh conference in Llandudno in North Wales, there was this motorcade of Massey Ferguson's and other manufacturers of the megafauna of the farmyard trundling past, making plenty of noise, and their drivers were as well outside of the conference. And what we're going to see tomorrow is going to be pretty big, I think. So there's this mass lobby of MPs that's going to go on, a couple of thousand farmers gathering and hearing from Tom Bradshaw, who's the president of the National Farmers Union. In his speech first thing tomorrow morning, language is pretty stark. This betrayal is extraordinary. I don't think I've ever seen the industry this angry, he'll say. Nothing short of a stab in the back. There's never been a budget this bad for farming in my lifetime. And you've got the government, who incidentally met with Mr. Bradshaw today. So Steve Reed, the Environment Secretary, invited Mr. Bradshaw in for a meeting. Absolutely insistent, ministers, that they are not going to budge. They think the current system isn't fair and isn't sustainable, and lots of people have used agricultural land as a way of dodging inheritance tax, and they want to close that loophole. And they argue the vast majority of farms will not be affected by this. But there is a dispute too over the numbers.
Yes, so standing firm, but an awareness that this is not going away, as you said. Is there anything the government is doing beyond trying to convince the farmers that, look, we're going to stick by this policy?
Not really. I mean, what they are doing is trying to explain the numbers to try and, in their view, to take as many people with them as they can. So they say that no one with a claim when it comes to an estate of below £1 million would face any inheritance tax. And some, including those if they lost a spouse and a spouse was to inherit the farm, there would be up to £3 million that was exempt. And they make the point that those that are charged at half the rate, 20%, that the rest of folk who are in line for an inheritance tax bill pay. They're trying to make a broader argument too about the state of public services and make that argument in the context of people in the countryside. They lean on their favourite crutch of justification, which is the idea of this £20 billion black hole, and I think we'll hear them do that again. But they are absolutely insistent that they are not going to go in for any mitigations, any attempt to smoothen or lessen the impact or the cliff edge, if you like, of this on some people. And from the farmers' perspective, and we'll hear this language from them tomorrow, not only are they annoyed about this agricultural property relief, to give it its full title, which has existed up until now around inheritance tax, they also point to really bad weather in the last few years that's made things difficult, the whole business of adjusting to a post Brexit subsidy, and then also the turnover of farming ministers, about five in the last 5 years. So I think you'll hear them talk about the straw and the camel's back, etc., etc. But nonetheless, this is now a noisy problem that this government has not just inherited, but seems to have sugar coated made considerably worse from their perspective. And the challenge, Jimmy, and the really big challenge at the heart of this from the government's perspective is there a perception that they simply do not understand a significant chunk of the population? And I don't just mean farmers by that, I mean the wider rural community. My mind is cast back 20 odd years to the Countryside Alliance protests, which were absolutely huge. Tomorrow's protests won't be on that scale, but where an individual and relatively small issue, even in the context of rural Britain, fox hunting, became totemic around wider questions of the extent to which the then Labour government understood the countryside. And this Labour government will be determined to try to ensure, though they don't seem to be succeeding so far, that it doesn't happen again, that history doesn't repeat itself, with a different case study being the prompt for that anger.
Chris Mason. Well, among those travelling to London tomorrow is Sam Pimblett, a farmer from Saffron Walden. His father and uncle own the arable farm where he works. Some of the land is rented out to tenant farmers. And I asked him why he decided to travel to London for tomorrow's rally.
Out of sheer, well, more than frustration with the government, who sort of have promised us several things over the years. And this is, for many people, the straw that's broke the camel's back. And particularly with the inheritance tax changes that we were promised back in the spring that weren't going to be touched. That is a real threat to family farms across the country, including my own.
The straw that broke the camel's back. So this is not just about this one relatively new Labour government and what it's done, but this is going over several years, other decisions by previous Conservative governments as well, is it?
And before that, you know, farming hasn't been an economically strong business for a long time. And the inheritance tax changes that they're proposing at the moment would basically make our business unviable. And I wouldn't be able to trade my way out to pay that tax if I had to.
So just tell us a bit about the farm, that it's your father and your uncle that co-own it. Is that correct?
Yeah. And we, as a family, have been here for 120 years now. Like many cases, the advice has always been use the agricultural property relief to pass the farm on through generations, basically pass it on freely. It's not a loophole. It's passed on something that, yes, has a high value to it, but actually doesn't generate that much cash.
What would the changes mean for you personally then, do you think?
I would be liable for in the region of £1.7 to £2 million in inheritance tax, which even if I had, were able to pay this over the 10-year period as they're proposing, we don't make anywhere near that to pay that. Our return on that capital, if you want to call it, is less than 1%. It just is completely unviable for us to continue at that point.
So what would that mean for you then?
We would have to, unfortunately, pack up. You know, it's so far out of kilter that it would just be the end of what we're doing, because if we had to sell that much to pay that off, it would take 20%, 25% out of our business in order to pay it.
The government is saying that only about 500 estates a year will pay more under this new scheme than they would have done previously. Is this a lot more than you would have paid under the previous scheme?
And I think that depends on which government department you're asking, because the Treasury Department doesn't match up with DEFRA figures at the moment. This is a policy that's been put together on bad data. For it to sort of not have even been mentioned till I think even about 10 days before the budget, feels like it's just been rushed through, not really thought out. And, you know, my question to the government is, I don't really understand what they were trying to do with it. If you're someone who has, you know, lots of money from other interests and you're buying farmland, you're still perhaps going to be able to do that. But the family farm isn't going to be able to trade their way out of this.
Well, they're arguing, aren't they, that this is actually to reduce the price of land for aspiring farmers, because people who are buying up farmland and not farming on it, just using it to avoid inheritance tax, will be priced out of the market and will actually help aspiring farmers. Do you buy that at all?
No, because at the moment their threshold of a million actually, although it sounds like a lot of money, doesn't buy you a viable farm, unfortunately. And if we start dropping values massively, I've got some serious debts that are serviced and that would fall out of balance with the bank as well.
When the government says, when the farming minister says the vast majority of farmers will be fine and that under 500 farms a year are likely to be affected, what's your response?
Go back and check your figures, because they are a long, long way off. I can't think of any of my neighbours who would fall under that bracket and not have to pay anything. For most farms, that sort of number is, I'm going to probably hazard a guess, it's probably near 6, 7, 8, 10 million perhaps. for most farms. And all the while, you know, there are several other measures that are in the budget that actually we probably ought to be talking a bit more about. But actually, this is the one that's going to finish us off.
So look, you've got criticism across the political spectrum. But I mean, in terms of what Labour, this Labour government has done, do you think that they have seen a group of people that they feel probably won't be voting for them? And farmers have traditionally not voted Labour and thought, we can do this, we can get away with this politically?
No, because I sat in front of Keir Starmer last year and he said, every day seems to bring a new existential threat to farming and Labour would offer us a new deal, a better deal. Little did we know at that point that the biggest threat to farming in this country would be him and his Chancellor.
Sam Pemblett, farmer from Saffron Walden, who will be coming to London for that rally tomorrow. Let's hear from Labour now. We can speak to the Labour MP for Loughborough, Dr. Jeevan Sander. Good evening.
Good evening. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, thanks for coming back on the programme. Well, you heard what that farmer said, that he had listened to Keir Starmer and he feels betrayed. And there are many others like him. What do you say in response?
I think Sam spoke a lot also about the failures we've seen in farming policy over the past few years. And I would agree with that. And that's why we are investing so much into farming. We're really proud of farmers and the contribution that they make. This budget had $5 billion on sustainable food production over the next 2 years, the highest ever amount, $208 million to deal with serious diseases, $60 million on flood defences, investment in rural infrastructure and police to get rural crime down. But all of that, the public services, the public investment does need to be paid for. And that is paid for here by the wealthiest landowners.
Not just the wealthiest. So that's the point, though, isn't it? I mean, he is not among the wealthiest and he's not the only one saying it. We've got the leader of the Liberal Democrats, for example, Sred Davey, says that the figures that the government's putting out, 500 a year being affected, nothing like what's really going to be the case. I mean, Sred Davey's talking about 70,000 farms being affected.
Well, I used to work at the Treasury. I know how stringent these policy costings are. I absolutely stand behind those figures. More broadly, those are 3 in 4 farms unaffected. But of course, because you're paying just over the threshold, it means that the very richest farms, if you like, are being hit the hardest by this tax change. So we saw, for example, before, the top 7% of farms or the top 7% of landowners getting 40% of the benefit. And that is some of the tax we're paying for the wealthiest landowners to pay for the investment to every rural community of farmer benefits.
And I know those are the figures the government's putting out and you're standing by them. But again, we've got Sam, this concrete example saying, look, this is the thing that will tip us over the edge, the changes to inheritance tax rules. What do you say to that?
Well, I would encourage Sam and every other farmer to look, see how much they're liable. I only caught the end of that interview, but I think Sam spoke about the £1 million threshold. If you add in the couple's allowance, it does get up to over $3 million, or at $3 million rather. So I would encourage every farmer to look at whether or not how much his tax will hit them, indeed how much it does as well. More broadly, again, the 75% of farms unaffected for investment that will benefit all of them. I know how much farmers have been hit. That's what this government is investing in.
Sir Keir Starmer has distanced himself from comments by a former advisor to former Labour Prime Minister Tony Blair, John McTurnan, who said Britain doesn't need small farmers. But there's clearly a perception amongst some smaller farmers that this government doesn't get it or has told them that it would be more sympathetic to them than the figures in the budget have turned out to be.
Well, farmers are the stewards of our land. They produce the food that we eat. They know more about our countryside than the rest of us. Have kept it for generations and will keep it for generations more. I'm incredibly proud of the contribution that farmers have made and continue to make to this country, as is every other single Labour MP.
But you need to sell that to the farmers, don't you? You've got, we don't know how many, but possibly a few thousand coming to London tomorrow. Will you just carry on telling them that look, the figures that they have don't add up, that this policy is going to go through? Is there any form of mitigation that the government might consider, do you think?
Well, this policy has been set in the budget. So the idea is, what are the investments we are paying for with this money, right? What are the investments in sustainable food production that benefits every single farmer? What is the amount we're going to spend on rural crime and dealing with diseases and dealing with flood damage. Those are the kind of things that we are paying for from the wealthiest landowners to benefit every single farmer. More broadly, absolutely, I'm here to listen and speak to every single farmer, as every Labour MP. I will do so in my constituency. I know colleagues will continue to do that across the country.
Jeevan Sander, Labour MP for Loughborough. Thanks very much indeed. Coming up later on in the programme, the voice of an English king brought to life after half a millennium.
The clarity and charity of the sun's light is so great that when it is poured on the other heavenly bodies, the sun sheens with no less light and splendour.
We'll explore how linguistics experts recreated the voice of Richard III. Now, we were hearing there about the importance of farming, food supply, and of course the price of food has been on many minds in recent years. One common grocery item in particular seemed to have exemplified the surging price of food. But if you've been stocking up on olive oil recently, you'll have had a pleasant surprise. After reaching record high prices at the beginning of the year, is up 150% compared to the end of 2021. Prices are beginning to fall, and one of the largest producers of olive oil, Spain's De Olio, says that prices are set to halve from their peak over the next few months. Well, let's explore why this is happening, what caused the spike in the first place. We can speak to Irini Djorgoglu, who's an olive oil sommelier and the 2019 winner of MasterChef. Good evening, Irini.
Hello, good evening there.
So, well, let's start with the price spike. What was behind it?
Oh, like so many things in our lives these days, climate is behind a lot that goes wrong. And unfortunately, prolonged drought and very high temperatures throughout the Mediterranean have impacted on the production of countries. So Spain, being the biggest producer in the world, last year produced 830,000 tons. Well, this year, and this is the good news that De Olio want to share, is expected to produce between 1.2 and 1.4 million tons. So you can immediately see that if the pricing is dependent on supply and demand, the supply is a very good reason, the expected increased supply is a very good reason why we consumers should be happy.
Happy, does that mean necessarily that the prices are going to fall as far as they seem to be predicting?
Tricky. And of course, we all need a good story. And De Olio, with about 180 million litres bottled and sold worldwide, need to spread the good word, if you like. However, it is a little bit early. The harvesting has just begun, and we won't really know until December and January how well all the countries have done. Also, there are middlemen. There are different reasons why the olive oil is priced what it is, and we find it on the shelf of the supermarket. So are we going to see it as low as that? Probably not, but it's nice not to have the fear. And the sentiment at the moment is quite negative with regard to olive oil. And if De Olio are trying to change that, well, good for them. Because I'm a big proponent of olive oil, particularly extra virgin olive oil. So any good news is a blessing.
Is there something that an olive needs in particular to produce lots of good quality oil? Is there a perfect set of conditions?
Well, the olive tree needs the water. You see, when it is flowering and fruiting in the spring months, it needs the water then in the ground. In the summer months, actually, the olive tree is quite drought resistant. So in the summer months, when typically in the Mediterranean, we don't have a lot of rain, July and August, it doesn't matter. If the ground, however, doesn't have enough water in the early autumn months, then the olives are not going to plump up and have a lot of oil content, because they do have water content. And what we've seen in Italy this year is some late rainfall in the autumn, very near to harvest time. The olives have absorbed it, but they don't have enough time to convert it to olive oil.
Fascinating insight. Thank you so much for your expertise, Irini Djorgoglu there. Olive oil sommelier 2019 MasterChef winner there on why the olive oil prices are fluctuating so much. Now, there's still no official confirmation that the United States is allowing Ukraine to use its long-range missiles to strike targets inside Russia, but there's plenty of reaction to the policy change that was briefed to the New York Times. The Kremlin has predictably condemned it. Tonight, the Ukrainian foreign minister has described it as a game changer for his country. So will it change the calculations of Ukraine's European allies? The UK has been lobbying the Biden administration to take this decision. And at the G20 summit in Rio, Keir Starmer was asked whether he would approve the use of British Storm Shadow missiles inside Russia.
I'm not going to get into operational details because Putin is the only winner in that situation. But I've been really clear for a long time now. We need to double down. We need to make sure Ukraine has what is necessary for as long as necessary, because we cannot allow Putin to win this war.
France's foreign minister has said his country remains open to the possibility of allowing the use of its missiles to strike Russian territory. But Germany has ruled out sending its long-range Taurus missiles to Ukraine. This was Chancellor Olaf Scholz also at the G20.
Why I don't consider the delivery of Taurus cruise missiles to be appropriate is that they could only be used if responsibility for target control is shared. That is something I cannot and will not take responsibility for. At the same time, we have a clear understanding that the powerful weapons we have already supplied, artillery, long-range systems and rocket launchers, are not to be used to strike deep into Russian territory.
Well, I'm joined now by Armida von Rey, who is the head of Chatham House's Europe programme. Good evening.
Good evening.
Put into perspective what Germany has done so far when it comes to arms transfers to Ukraine. It's the largest supplier. How much has it actually given?
Yeah, so Germany is the largest European supplier of military aid to Ukraine, right behind the US. So it's really done a lot, and of course, as of France, as of the UK. But Germany has also very much followed the US's line and been more cautious on the supply of the Taurus missiles that you've talked about just now, but also any kind of weapon systems that they consider might bring about a risk of further escalation or Russia escalating the war with NATO allies.
Of course, this all comes just a few days after Olaf Scholz spoke on the phone to Vladimir Putin for the first time in a couple of years. I mean, does that partly explain why he is, for the moment at least, holding back from allowing Taurus missiles to go to Ukraine?
I mean, I think we need to place this in the domestic, but also the international context in which Germany is currently operating. The domestic context is one where obviously, the coalition government has collapsed. Scholz now leads a minority coalition and increasingly stands alone in his position on supplying long-range missiles to Ukraine. Even his coalition partner, the Greens, are for that. But Germany is also a country that's had really long-standing relations with Russia and had to do a massive 180 when it came to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, where Germany had to, fully change its, particularly its energy sources. But it was always a country, European country, that was very close to Russia. Scholz is trying to present himself as a prudent chancellor or peacemaker chancellor. And especially if we're thinking again about that domestic context where elections have been called for February and they're going into campaign mode, they're really getting themselves ready. He's trying to present himself as the prudent chancellor rather than one that will escalate.
Briefly, I mean, all countries have got an eye on the incoming Trump administration. Does the same hold for Germany, or is it, as you suggested, solely focused on its own domestic political upheaval?
I mean, all European countries are keeping an eye on what's happened in the US, and obviously they're all responding in their own different ways to the to Trump's re-election. Scholz knows that he would have to build ties with Trump quite quickly, but equally, it is so unlikely that he will become chancellor again. So that's not going to be for him to do.
Armida von Rey from Chatham House's Europe programme. Thanks very much. Now, it sounds like a sliding doors moment in British comedy history. Among the documents from Eric Morecambe's family home that are going up for auction in the new year is a 1950 Dear Eric letter from his comedy partner, Ernie Wise. "Well, Eric, I want to get straight to the point," Ernie writes. "I want us to break up the act. I'm afraid it won't work." Well, that was sent 3 years before one of the most popular double acts in history got their first radio series, and around two decades before their Christmas shows became a traditional part of festive family viewing. I've been hearing the reaction of the comedy historian and founder of the comedy website Beyond the Joke, Bruce Dessau.
I had heard there was a letter from Ernie saying that he wanted to break up the act, but to actually see a copy of it, I found that quite sort of spine-tingling.
It got pretty short shrift, though, didn't it?
Well, Eric seemed to talk him around quite quickly. Yes, he responded and Ernie kind of was back on board again. I imagine they must have had a bad gig or something, or maybe a couple of bad nights in a variety show or something. They hadn't quite made it onto TV then, but maybe Ernie felt things weren't progressing as fast as he would have liked.
Yeah, they hadn't even made it to their own radio show. So this was early, early in their career.
That's the thing. I think Eric was right. I think Eric obviously sensed that they had some chemistry together, they had potential. I have to say, I'd never got the impression that Ernie was someone who was plagued with self-doubt. So it's interesting that he actually was doubting his abilities behind the scenes.
Doubting his or their abilities, I suppose. Was it the chemistry that he was wondering might really have been so special?
That's a good question, but I don't think at that stage he would have gone solo. I don't think Ernie was thinking that he could be more successful on his own, and I don't think he would have. I think the chemistry was so brilliant between them, as anyone who's seen any of their, you know, BBC Christmas specials would know. They were the perfect double act.
You're playing all the wrong notes.
I'm playing all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order.
What is the history like then of big comedy duos? Were there quite a few of them that were just sort of grinning and bearing it and sticking together because they had a winning formula, even though they didn't perhaps necessarily get on, had comedic differences, shall we say?
It can be hard, I think, to draw the parallel with bands, you know, the Beatles, for example. You start off as friends, you know, sometimes you know each other since your school days. But then, you know, success can change people. You know, one thinks the other's getting too much attention, or one thinks the other's stepping on their punchlines and upstaging them. There were lots of great double acts around the time of Morecambe and Wise, Little and Large, Cannon and Ball. They were all successful, but there were cases when they didn't quite get on. You know, the other famous one were the brothers, Mike and Bernie Winters, you know, even though they were siblings, or maybe because they were siblings, maybe they were, Mike and Bernie Winters were like the Gallagher brothers of the comedy world. They didn't get on and they eventually split up. And instead, Bernie Winters went off and formed a double act with a St. Bernard dog called Schnorbitz.
Yes, and Celebrity and, you know, Squares, dog, he was an ever-present, wasn't he?
Well, that's it, because the dog couldn't answer back. I guess he would always get top billing with a dog.
Well, let's end where we began with Eric and Ernie. You said that when you read that letter, it was shivers down the spine. What would things have been like if we'd never had Morecambe and Wise on our television screens, do you think?
It would be a kind of different world. Christmas Day would have been very quiet without Eric and Ernie's Christmas specials. You know, thank goodness Eric talked him out of it. For both of them and for the rest of us as well. Let your arms be as wide as the sunrise. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.
And that was the comedy historian Bruce Dessau. And that is the song of the slender-billed curlew, as recorded by Adam Gretton. Well, the bird has just gained an unenviable place in the annals of ornithology. Today, it became the first bird species found in mainland Europe, judged to be extinct in half a millennium. Among the institutions involved in reaching that conclusion was London's Natural History Museum, where Dr. Alex Bond is the senior curator in charge of birds, and he described the now vanished slender-billed curlew.
It's a bird that most folks in the UK certainly won't have seen because it's never been recorded here, but it stands about a foot tall, looks very similar to the curlew that we have here, which is a large wader, a bird found in coasts and estuaries, and it's got a long bill that sort of bends down, which it uses to probe in the sand for all sorts of tasty bits.
You're using the present tense there, but you do not think that there are any flying around anymore.
Yeah, that's one of the strange things about extinction. We talk about things as though they're still around, when in fact, no. For the slender-billed curlew, we reckon the chance of it still existing is probably less than both you and I getting struck by lightning during this interview.
And how do you come to that conclusion?
So what we did was we compiled all the evidence from the last 170 years, going back to the mid-19th century. We looked for reports, just sightings, photographs, and specimens. And reports could be, you know, somebody saying, oh, I saw a slender-billed curlew down on my farm. Then you've got photographs, which you can look at and you can say, yep, that's probably a slender-billed curlew. And then you've got museum specimens, which are the gold standard because you can hold it in your hand. You can look and you can say, right, on the underside of the wing, it has this little bit of black, which means it's definitely a slender-billed curlew. And we can take these three different lines of evidence, pop them into a computer program, which basically estimates the probability that the bird is still with us, looking at, you know, sort of the patterns in these sightings over time.
And the probability is, well, next to nothing.
It's infinitesimally small, yeah.
Well, tell us about the bird.
It breeds in Kazakhstan and Russia on the steppes, and it would migrate through, across the Ural Mountains, in through Europe, down through Italy, Greece, into North Africa. And we think it probably went extinct for a couple of reasons. One is that it was tasty. It's a large wader. They're migratory, so they're going to have lots of fat. So very, very tasty. And then sort of in the 1950s, 60s, huge changes in land use in the former Soviet Union, conversion of wetlands into arable fields and croplands. And that's where these birds breed. And once that disappears, they were pretty much doomed.
But there have been plenty of others around the world that have gone extinct previously, right?
You're absolutely right. So it's the first mainland European bird to go extinct since 1500. But in that time, we've lost between 150 and 200 species globally. We've got 1,400 species that are currently on the red list, threatened with extinction, and 231 of those are critically endangered. They are virtually on the precipice. So if we haven't been paying attention to date, we really need to open our ears to the story that these birds are trying to tell us.
What can we as individuals do?
Ultimately, this problem is bigger than individuals. It's something that truly requires a global solution. You have a curlew that would breed in Central Asia, migrate over the Ural Mountains, in through Europe, in through the Mediterranean, and winter in North Africa, linking all those habitats together. No single country or jurisdiction could possibly have saved the slender-billed curlew. It requires coordinated, directed action. And that's the only way that we're going to be able to save not just birds, but wildlife and habitats, and ultimately the planet on which we all depend.
Dr. Alex Bond, a senior curator in charge of birds at the Natural History Museum. For the 350 history buffs in the room, it must have been the equivalent of ABBA Voyage. Last night at the York Theatre, a digital avatar of Richard III was unveiled, speaking in a specially created voice. 539 years after Richard's death at the Battle of Bosworth, here is the technologically reconstructed monarch giving an address in a Yorkshire accent about conferring the offices of the Prince of Wales and Earl of Chester on his son Edward.
Wherefore, we firmly decree, for us and our heirs, that the said Edward, our son, shall have the name, steel, title, dignity, and honour of the Principality of Wales and the Earldom of Chester, aforesaid to him and his heirs, forever.
Well, that voice was created with the help of actor Thomas Dennis by the leading linguistics professor David Crystal, and he told me what evidence he'd used to reconstruct the voice of one of England's most controversial kings.
The first thing is you look at the spellings. Spellings were a real guide to pronunciation in the old days, not a guide now. Modern English, no real guide from the spelling of a word as to how you pronounce it. But in the old days, spelling was a really useful indication. People wrote as they sounded to a very large extent in the Middle Ages. And then the second kind of evidence are the rhymes that poets used, rhymes that don't work now, but they must have worked at the time they were written, otherwise you'd have been a lousy poet. So, for instance, Chaucer, which is the period of Richard, of course. I mean, Richard's grandmother could have spoken to Chaucer. Chaucer rhymes words like, was and glass. So it must have been was and glass, you know, that sort of thing. So the rhymes. And then the third kind of evidence is that during the 16th century, which is not so long after Richard, really, people started to write books and articles about how English words were to be pronounced. And so that kind of evidence, along with the others, means that you can reconstruct an accent from that period with, oh, I would say about, you know, 90% accuracy. You can never be 100%, but it was pretty good. I think we get as close as you can get to the speech of Richard.
Well, what about pinpointing the regional aspect of the accent?
What you get in this earlier form of English, the Richard kind of English, is a bit of an amalgam, really, of different kinds of accent that today we'd recognise. For example, the R, the letter R, is pronounced after a vowel all the time. You get words like splendour and poured for poured, that sort of thing, and that makes you think, ooh, Somerset or somewhere like that. And then on the other hand, the very first line of the extract is the sun's licht.
The sun's licht is so great that when it is poured on the other heavenly bodies, the sun sheens with no less licht and splendour.
Sun? Oh, not sun. Sun. Nice rounded vowel. Very northern, that, isn't it? Licht, going up towards Scotland. And then so great. Well, now we're in Yorkshire. when you add all these effects up, what you get is an accent that is not like any one accent today, but has echoes of many. And the dominant one, the dominant voice is, I think, Yorkshire.
We are in Yorkshire, but we are also on the throne, aren't we? The fact he was king, what about factoring that in? Would his accent have been different from commoners in a pronounced way?
Not in any really significant way. It's not like today. I mean, today we have this crucial difference between received pronunciation, which is the traditional accent of, well, the BBC, apart from anything else, the southern British English accent, and then all the regional accents around the country. And that contrast, that received pronunciation, only arrived, you know, around about the year 1800. It's a very recent accent, really, a kind of class accent. But for that, there was no RP, there was no received pronunciation. And so you don't get as great a difference between the speech of the upper classes and the speech of the lower classes, not in those days.
Professor David Crystal, I think a certain Chris Mason might have something to say about the BBC's received pronunciation being southern. Anyway, that is the world tonight. Just before we go, a quick look at tomorrow's papers. The Daily Telegraph goes with those farmers' protests. Farmers must pay up for the NHS, says Reeves, is the headline. The Guardian reports UK expected to follow US in letting Kiev use missiles to attack Russia. This is James Kimarasamy. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.